The story I want to tell you today, that or at least in my three lectures, focusing on ambitwister string theories. But so these are really based on the formulae that were developed by Freddy Cachazzo, Song He, and Ellis Yuan, who you've been hearing from earlier on in the week. So the attraction of these ambitwister string theories is that they combine some of the most integrational parts of string theory. So in string theory, one has this sort of standard fact that you can unite sort of many Feynman diagrams into just one object. So well, at 4 points, it's maybe not so remarkable that you end up combining four diagrams into one sort of string diagram. But there's only those three Feynman diagrams. But by the time you get to endpoints, there's various factorial squared expressions worth of diagrams here, which can still be expressed in one string diagram. But of course, string theory is a different theory from conventional field theory. It has an infinite tower of massive states, and it's not necessarily the theory that you were first interested in. The usual idea is that as you take the string tension to infinity, you get back to ordinary field theory. But a side product of that is that the Riemann surface somehow shrinks down into diagrams, and you get back to a field theory description. And so you lose this sort of beautiful unification of all of the Feynman diagrams into one string diagram. So, however, the formulae of, the CHY formulae, as I'll call them, that you were hearing about from Freddy earlier on in this week, showed that, in fact, maybe there was something just in conventional field theory which had this simplicity. And the so they worked this through simply at the level of the formulae. I guess they started perhaps with, I'm not sure what the history is, with twister strings, and just worked around and played with those formulae until they saw that they could apply to almost any theory that you wanted to lay your hands on. So in their most recent paper, they can do Galileons and DBI and all sorts of weird theories that you may not have first thought would have such a natural description. What I want to tell you about in these lectures is how the CHY formulae can be understood as arising from a string theory in ambitwister space. And what I'm going to have to do first is to tell you sort of what ambitwister spaces are and what people were doing with them when they were first introduced. These were introduced actually in the 70s, first of all by Witten and by Eisenberg, Yaskin and Green. So these were meant to be ways of describing Yang-Mills theories in such a way. So these were meant to be twistorial ways of describing Yang-Mills theories, which overcame the restriction to self-duality that twister methods were subjected to at the time and are still subjected to unless you go through this string theory route. And the ideas, so I guess there's sort of Witten and Eisenberg, Yaskin and Green, in 78, and then there's so this was Yang-Mills, and then there was the corresponding work for gravity by Claude Lebrun and myself and so on through the 80s, 86 and 1991. So that was a gravitational story. And I'll actually focus on the gravitational story mostly. The So in these lectures then, I'm going to spend this lecture really on this sort of classical story just concerning gravity, and then tomorrow's lecture will explain how to do string theory in these spaces. So what is ambi-twister space? Well, ambi-twister space So this is equal to the space of complex null geodesics in a complexified space-time. So what do these things mean? So we imagine that we're given an analytic real space-time, so I'll put a subscript R for the analytic case, and we have a metric, say. So this is going to be a d-dimensional manifold, and a metric. I'll be agnostic about the signature because the first thing we're going to do is to complexify. And the fact that it's analytic means that we can extend the coordinates x mu from rd to dd to sort of d complex dimensions. And the fact it's analytic means that we can the transition functions for the manifold functions and the metric have finite radius of convergence and so extend to the the complexification. Extend to some neighborhood of the real slice in the complex. So they extend to some small thickening. And I won't go through the details, but this will give rise to a d-dimensional complex manifold, which will be M, and a holomorphic metric, which I'll call capital G. And sometimes I'll put indices on it for as if in a coordinate representation. So in that complex manifold, we can complexify all of the familiar things that one does, and just really work as if you're working on the real manifold, but with coordinates that are allowed to become complex and with functions that are all holomorphic. And so in particular, you can write down null geodesics and write down the geodesic equation as an equation for holomorphic curves sitting inside the complex manifold. So the way that we often do this, one of the first things I want to show is that the ambi-twister space is a holomorphic symplectic manifold. And in fact, it will have some additional structures, which I'll talk about in a moment. So the usual way to understand a space of geodesics as a symplectic manifold is to start with the phase space, the cotangent bundle. So these can be holomorphic coordinates on just the cotangent bundle of the space-time. And So on the cotangent bundle, we have various structures. We have a symplectic potential, which is just tautological form theta, which is P mu dx mu, and symplectic form omega equals d theta dp, just a familiar one. But these are holomorphic forms, though. So this is a 1-0 form in the usual parlance. This is a 2-0 form. We won't ever, well, at least, sorry, we will consider anti-holomorphic things, but only in the context of cohomology. Okay, so these are the main structures. The other main structure is that we can rescale the momentum. So we have the Euler vector field, which p mu d by dp mu, and this generates scalings. P goes to alpha times P. Okay, so we usually think of the geodesics then as arising from a Hamiltonian flow. So our Hamiltonian flow for P squared, which is just going to be the upstairs metric contracted into the momentum. And that they're generated by the Hamiltonian vector field which I'll just write as x sub p squared defined by so here I'm using this maybe slightly non-standard symbol of a sort of well, I'm not sure how non-standard that. This is just meant to be contraction of a vector field into a form. So again, just note that everything here is holomorphic, and the geodesic equation will be a holomorphic curve. So the integral curves of xp squared are equal to sort of geodesics with parallel propagated momentum p mu with g mu nu p mu tangent to curve. So hopefully that's sort of just familiar law. And let's see if they go up. So we then just define ambitwister space to be a holomorphic symplectic quotient. So you restrict to p squared equals zero, and we quotient by the Hamiltonian, the integral curves of the Hamiltonian vector field. And there's a certain amount of work to do to make yourself to restrict your neighbourhood so that this is actually a manifold. There's always a risk of things having problems, which we won't worry about. Okay, so anyway, so the standard result is that on p squared equals zero, the derivative of the symplectic form certainly vanishes, and from its definition, this is minus d of p squared, but that vanishes on the set p squared equals zero, and the symplectic form descends, but so too does the symplectic potential. So this is special to p squared equals zero. For general geodesics, of course, it's always symplectic. The spatial geodesics is symplectic, but we only have the symplectic potential when the geodesics have zero p squared. So this vanishes, and also the Euler vector field. Well, it gives you back a multiple of the Hamiltonian vector field. So the so all three structures, theta, omega, epsilon, descend to ambitwister space. And in fact, that they're all related. So omega, of course, is equal to d theta, and theta is equal to epsilon contracted into omega. And it's what I mean by holomorphic symplectic. You have a holomorphic two-form that is non-degenerate as a two-form on the complex tangent bundle.
So then, you're adding lots of details into.
It's
degenerate, right? On your, I mean, as you need T star of.
Well, it's degenerate in the complex, I guess. It's degenerate on complex vector fields, but not on real ones. Maybe one of the ways that I'm hiding something here is the fact that the integral curves of this vector field are complex curves. They're holomorphic curves embedded in M. So they're actually two-dimensional manifolds as real manifolds. I guess the point is that that two manifold is spanned by both XP squared and its complex conjugate. So as a real manifold, the real and imaginary parts of the vector field are a two-dimensional integrable distribution, and they have an integral surface, which is the complex null geodesic.
Omega is it an invertible form on T star of M, or it's invertible only on the holomorphic part?
Well, on T star M, on T. Sorry, yes, I'm thinking about everything as you're doing your linear algebra on the. The complex, the T10 and omega 10, and so everything's non-degenerate on T10 and omega 10, the holomorphic tangent vectors and holomorphic forms.
So here you don't really mean T star M, which contains T10.
I guess maybe that notation is perhaps confusing in this context. In fact, later on in my notes, I'm more careful. So there are all these identifications, aren't there? So if you take the real cotangent bundle has a complex structure, and the point is it's not wrong either. So what you're thinking of is the complexification of T star M. And that does decompose into a holomorphic and anti-holomorphic part. So the real T star M can be identified with either the holomorphic or the anti-holomorphic as you like. And I guess I was being a bit sloppy there with that identification.
So you start off with the real analytic space, and yeah. Its complexification is a small neighborhood in
real
space of that. So you sort of just figure that thing up without worrying about transition maps extending all the way through.
So you just thicken away from the real slice by as far as the radius convergence, or maybe a little bit less. You just want to have some open neighborhood of the real slice. And by and large, you just control it, so it's a thin thickening.
It's inside T star M, is that right?
So MR was a submanifold of a totally real submanifold of M, and then T star M was a cotangent bundle of M. Yeah.
But you're reading the 1-0 part of the cotangent.
Yeah. Well, you can identify T star M with 1-0. Yeah. Sorry, there are lots of identifications here which you can get confused by with a linear algebra. And it's safest, really, just to think that you're just going complex and you're not going to think anti-holomorphic. Later on, we will think anti-holomorphic a bit, but only as regards cohomology. So, okay. So, anyway, so we end up with this space here. It has dimension. Well, we lost two dimensions, essentially. So we started off with d dimensions. We doubled by going up to the cotangent bundle. So we got 2d minus 2. But the other thing we'll do is we'll projectivize. So we'll the projective ambitwister space is where we quotient by the Euler vector field. And so this, of course, has dimension 1 less, 2d minus 3. This would be important for Lebrun's theory, but we have line bundles, which I'll denote as ON, defined over the projective space, such that ON. So these are holomorphic line bundles. And these are essentially functions that are homogeneous of weight n in P. And you know, the original ambitwister space here is actually the is a line, total space of a line bundle when you take the quotient, and that is actually equal to O minus 1. It's a standard sort of vector space over its projectivization. So you just, you could already do that at the level of the cotangent bundle. You could projectivize the fibers and end up with projective spaces. So this is, that the space that one works on when one's doing sort of complex geometry, and the projective space, the omega has a non-zero contraction with epsilon, so omega doesn't descend, but theta has a vanishing contraction with epsilon, so that does descend, but as theta is section one naught form, it has weight 1, so defines what's known as a contact structure. And again, brackets holomorphic. That is to say theta wedge d theta to top power, is that d minus 2 is not equal to 0. Okay, so that's a geometric structure we're working with, and just as a remark, there's locally there's no information in this structure, as we have a version of Darboux's theorem. Well, we could do Darboux's theorem on the non-projective space. So essentially by holomorphic analog of Darboux. However, what twister theory seeks to do is to encode the information of a space-time into the ambitwister space. Well, into a twister space more generally, And so the way we're going to do that is to actually think about the global structure rather than the local structure. And so the construction that I'm going to be talking about is modeled very closely on the first example of its type, which was Roger Penrose's nonlinear graviton construction, and it uses very similar ideas. So once you've sort of learned the general framework, one can sort of understand how all of these twisted constructions work in a similar way. So first of all, despite the fact there's no local information in this ambi-twister space, the original space-time. There was another remark I wanted to make here, which this is all conformally invariant. And only requires the conformal equivalence class of the metric G. It's a conformal equivalence class. That is, G is equivalent to sort of omega squared times G for omega non-zero function. So we can't hope to rebuild more than just the conformal structure, but the original conformal structure and manifold can be reconstructed from essentially just the complex structure on A from and and in fact, this is stable under small deformations of the complex structure of PA, but must allow a not just a change in the connection, but also the change in the conformal equivalence class of the metric, null geodesics to be null geodesics of a torsion connection. And again, this is sort of a conformal equivalence class in as much as it's determined by the null geodesics. And the third part of this, though, is that the Nabla is torsion-free if deformation preserves the existence of the symplectic potential. So I'll write that as a... So it may not be the one you first thought of course, you'll want to have the theta. This is a contact structure on this projective space. It is odd complex dimensional. So PA has, when I wrote down the dimensions of these things, these were all the complex dimensions.
What do you mean by C structure? Complex structure or contact structure?
Well, this is the contact structure on the projective space.
The C structure is, the big C structure means
complex. Oh, that's meant to be complex structure, sorry, yeah. C structure is complex structure, and then the theta is meant to be the contact structure.
So you're going to define what you mean by a complex structure on PA, or you assume it's...
Well, I'll do something explicitly with deformations, but I'm not going to do anything explicit with the full-blown complex structure. So when you have a complex manifold, you can think of its complex structure as being defined either in a check format, just as gluing together your manifold with patching functions that are holomorphic. So everything is holomorphic in that point of view. So these are the transition functions. Or you can think about it in terms of the D bar operator. But both of those are useful ways to think. So the so you can deform. Sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself in talking about that. So, but maybe just to say what I mean by the complex structure on the manifold, I mean the data of all the either the data of all the holomorphic transition functions used to glue the manifold together, or the D bar operator on the manifold, on function on the manifold. Yeah.
If we review all this construction and try to run the same thing for usual geodesics and Riemannian with offset technique, will it work, or will you get stuck somewhere?
No, I think it'll work. It'll work for similar reasons.
Yeah, but it may
well not be quite as efficient and not have. But yes, I mean, I don't see. Oh, just a moment. When I say that, there is there will be awkwardnesses actually, and I'll come to that in a moment. So okay, so
can you explain the second icon of the theorem? What do you mean by it must allow?
So what we have here then is a correspondence between manifolds with conformal structure and spaces of complex null geodesics endowed with a complex structure. And the idea is that, the only sort of moduli you can see here is a conformal structure. So you can imagine varying the conformal structure, and of course our construction here will construct you another ambi-twister space. But you could also imagine just deforming the complex structure on the ambi-twister space in the sense of deforming these transition functions. And you would then ask the question of, is that a space of complex null geodesics from some manifold M with conformal metric? And the answer is yes, but you might grow, your null geodesics may not be the torsion-free geodesics of the Levi-Civita metric, but they may be the torsion geodesics of some more general connection.
So no matter how you vary the metric, you always have the same underlying smooth space as the complex structure. You never change the topology.
That's right. So these are all also understood in the sense of small deformations. So not necessarily infinitesimal, but not very large. So we're not, I mean, one can, after a while, start to investigate such issues, but
fully faithful functor from, what does it mean to say you can reconstruct from the ambi-twister space? Does it mean that sending a space with conformal structure to the ambi-twister space is fully faithful functor?
I think that's the sort of thing I'm trying to say. I mean, I'm not quite sure what is entirely entailed by calling it a functor, but it is in some sense functorial. What I'm trying to say, it's invertible. I mean, what's obvious is you can construct the ambi-twister space. What's not obvious is that if you start deforming the ambi-twister space, you get something that resembles the space of null geodesics of some complexified space-time.
Does that mean that if you're given a holomorphic synthetic manifold with all these structures, and you know that it comes from this construction, you can reproduce the manifold?
Yeah. So I'm just going to outline the basic arguments here. So the basic argument, well, this is very much a sketch proof. It comes down to Kodaira theory. So Kodaira theory is a story about deformations of complex manifolds and of submanifolds within them. So the submanifolds we're going to be interested in are the submanifolds that correspond to a point in space-time. So each point in M is represented in ambi twister space by the light rays that go through the point X. So we have this kind of picture of all the light rays through X. These correspond to what I'm going to call QX. So this is the projective light cone, which I'll call Q of X, because it's essentially just the quadric inside the projective cotangent bundle at X. And so this is, so that's over epsilon, I guess. So this is an algebraic variety. It's a quadric of dimension. So a compact, complex manifold of dimension d minus 2. And so our strategy is going to be to reconstruct the space-time first as the moduli space of these Qs sitting inside the ambi twister space. And what Kodaira theory is going to tell us is that this process leads to a well-defined space-time. So given so if you're given your original ambi twister space, then we know that we have a QX inside ambi twister space, and we can reconstruct M as the moduli space of deformations of Q. And so this is something which Kodaira tells us how to study. So the way he does it is he says, let N be the normal bundle of Q in A. And so is everyone happy with the normal bundle? Yeah. And then Kodaira tells us that So this is a bundle over Q of X. If certain cohomology groups vanish, so if the first cohomology group vanishes, and I guess you also require the endomorphism. Then to vanish, then the then there exists a manifold M of deformations of QX. So basically the idea here is if there's your QX, you can look at sections of the normal bundle, and the idea is that you can exponentiate them. You find another one. And with tangent space equal to just H naught of the so the global sections of the normal bundle. No, I mean, finding the first QX would always be, in some sense, hard. We know it's there because it came from an original spacetime. But then with the stability result, you only need there to be one in a nearby spacetime, you know, from a nearby ambitwister space. So to a certain extent, the statement is that it's not constructive in that sense. I mean, you sort of need to start somewhere, but you might not have to start with the spacetime you first thought of. So, so that reconstructs the spacetime. It may actually reconstruct something larger than the original spacetime. There's a risk of that. And in fact, in three dimensions, you do. You find you actually get a four-dimensional space, and you find that you're solving a boundary value problem for some differential equations. But in higher dimensions, you really do just get the original spacetime back, perhaps with some extra bits that you hadn't thought of originally. The the idea is that you can reconstruct the geodesics by saying that if you now have two Qs, you have a QX, QY, well, generically they'll miss. But it's going to be a co-dimension one condition that they should meet. And if they do meet, then we can say that they're null connected. So there's X and there's Y. And so we can, given L in PA, we can define a curve gamma L in M, where this is equal to the Q, the Y such that QY contains L. And the dimensions all work out for this to give you a family of curves. And these curves, there's some twister yoga that actually tells you that these are the curves of a conformal structure, perhaps with a torsion connection. So this is part of the hard work of the Lebrun theorem, is to prove that these curves are actually. So I'll just assert these are geodesics of a torsion connection. And the geometry is sufficiently rigid that if you do have a contact structure, that has to have been the one that comes from the Hamiltonian process. So the torsion equals zero the theta descends. And that's an if and only if theta descends. PA. This is a calculation. So if you take the lead derivative of the theta, it's no longer a Hamiltonian. You see the generating vector field for the torsion geodesics are no longer Hamiltonian vector fields, and they simply don't preserve theta. It's not a hard calculation, but you sort of need to write out connection coefficients and things.
Does it make sense to ask if the torsion is ever totally skew symmetric?
It does, yes. So the totally skew symmetric part, I think, is forgotten in this. If I remember correctly, the totally skew part is not part of the conformally invariant part of the torsion. So these are all conformal equivalence classes. And just to say a word for stability, you imagine you have a one-parameter family of these Ambly twister spaces, and you can play the same game. These QXs still survive even when you vary the parameter T. And so everything just carries on using the same basic underlying theorem. And the basic underlying theorem is, of course, just an implicit function theorem in Banach spaces. So,
question?
Yeah.
So, your construction, you start with a space-time, but you immediately complexify it. So it seems that like you might as well start it with just a Euclidean space. But in the proof, it looks like it's essential that your matrix that you fixed had a signature.
Well, when you complexify, if you were to start with a Euclidean signature metric, when you complexify you'll acquire all sorts of null directions in the complex. So, of course, there are no null directions in the reals, but by complexification, you're... Yes, that's right. Okay, so it's instructive to... it's not only instructive, but the one thing that one of the main things I want to take from this for the Ambly twister string talks is actually how this really works in detail in linear theory. And in fact, the Penrose transform for Ambly twister space is the simplest example of a Penrose transform. I didn't write down the statements about stability, but I hope that was clear that stability follows from the same Cadara theory. First of all, if you want to sort of linearize this correspondence, one has to think about how it is that one's going to deform the complex structure on Ambly twister space. And in fact, by and large, we're not really interested in torsion. So we want to think about deformations of the complex structure that preserve the existence of this contact structure. So, usually when you think about deformations of a complex structure, you would have a cohomology group, which would be a first cohomology with, just to be clear, with coefficients in holomorphic tangent vectors. Are people familiar with this basic deformation theory? So the idea here is that the H1 in the Czech context would be functions defined on overlaps, and so these are vector fields which are sort of deforming the transition functions. Or in the Dolbo picture, these are 0-1 forms that are D-bar closed, so you think of this as being a variation of the D-bar operator, modulo diffeomorphisms. Sorry?
With coefficients and...
The holomorphic tangent vectors.
On the ambiguous system.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yes. Thank you. However, we want to preserve the contact structure as well. And in fact, you see the contact structure preserves the... contact structure preserves... determines the complex structure, because theta wedge d theta to the whichever power it was, d minus 2, is a top degree, so it's not equal to 0, is a top degree holomorphic form. And so determines, say, the anti-holomorphic vectors T0 1, P PA by annihilation. And so, in fact, since we want to preserve the existence of a contact structure, so we can say that deformations of the complex structure preserving the existence of theta just correspond to delta theta. And if you fold in the various equivalences, this will have to be thought of as you're just interested in the 0-1 part of this. And so now we're thinking of this, why don't I just say it's as a 0-1 form, but it has to have weight 1. It has to be D bar closed and define modulo exact. So we're really just looking at delta theta being in H1 PA of O1. That's a one form that's D bar closed, not one form that's D bar closed, modulo exact with values in this line bundle. So in fact, so what I want to do now is to ask, how does this actually correspond to a variation in the conformal structure? And we can actually answer a related question, a slightly more general question, using So the proposition then is that more generally, H1 PA ON is equal to trace free symmetric tensors G mu 1 up to mu naught up to mu n. So they have n plus 1 indices on m modulo derivative of tensors that have one less index. Symmetric tensors with one less index. So the this is I'm actually running out of time here, and what I actually wanted to do was to give an example as well. So I could just say a little bit about the proof. So this contains the result we want, in the sense that for n equals 1, this is a two-index tensor, so we think of this as a variation of the metric, modulo the trace-free part of derivatives of vectors, and that is what you expect for a variation in the conformal structure. So the way that you do this is there's a nice argument from you have a double vibration. You see, you have this. We constructed the ambitwister space as the projective cotangent bundle restricted to p squared equals zero, fibered over ambitwister space with fibers the lifts of null geodesics, and this fibers over M, and so this is p dot Nabla here. And you can use this to write down a short exact sheaf sequence. So if you have your ON on PA, well, you can lift those functions back up to QM and that gives you a function on this correspondence space just by pullback. So if this is pi 1, and this is pi 1 star, and then the functions on on QM now, and then the image of these pullback functions are those which are annihilated by p dot nabla, so that gives you om plus 1. That weight raises the homogeneity by 1. And so this leads to a long exact sequence in cohomology, and most of its entries vanish, and the co-boundary map gives you H1PA ON. Has H naught of QM OM plus 1 coming into it. So what you have to see is, and then we have P dot nabla, H naught QM ON. So what we have to see is that this description as a quotient is really this description that comes from the long exact sequence in cohomology. So anyway, it's a very simple argument. This goes to zero just by standard vanishing theorems and so on. The I need to finish up. So one of the things I did want to do here, though, was to give you a key example of that, which is... Okay. So when we study scattering amplitudes, we're going to be concerned with linearized deformations. So we build up a general scattering amplitude out of lots of perturbations of a metric. And so as an example, then, we can consider the case where G mu naught mu n is just given by a momentum eigenstate or a plane wave, and in fact I'll follow CHY in writing out its since this is symmetric and trace free, this epsilon here will be that epsilon will be a vector that's null, and this is manifestly symmetric, and what you can do is you can follow through this long exact sequence argument in detail. So how does this work? You start off with something in here. How does the co-boundary work? Well, you try and pull it back to something in the sheaf before, but you then discover that that what you've got is no longer closed, d bar closed. So you have an obstruction to pulling it back. So we'd like to. So first of all, we're thinking of this as a homogeneous function. So this is the homogeneous function of degree n plus 1 was that just obtained by contracting with the momentum. So we get epsilon dot p raised to the n plus 1th power times e to the 2 pi I k dot x. So it's probably easier doing this example than trying to prove the thing in general. Then we want something in ON such that I'm going to call it H in ON such that P dot nabla H is equal to I'll just call this object G. And it's easier to find that. So H equals, because of this special form of the X dependence, this is equal to epsilon dot P to the N plus 1 over K dot P. So when you, or 2 pi I K dot P, e to the 2 pi I K dot X. And so The problem with this, though, is it's no longer holomorphic. You have a manifest pole, so that's actually not a genuine pullback for the G, and so we define the delta of G to be, so I'm going to call this V in general, and that would be D bar of H, which is, well, this is all holomorphic except for this pole. So this is epsilon dot P to the M plus 1 times E to the 2 pi I K dot X. And when you take the derivative of the pole, you get a delta function, because this is just the standard result from complex analysis, whereby D bar of 1 over Z is a delta function at the origin. So this, so if we have a, so by definition, this is D bar of 1 over 2 pi I Z, and this is a delta function at the real part of Z times the imaginary part of Z times dz bar. And just various remarks here. This is first of all, that because of the support of the delta function, P dot nabla of V now actually vanishes. And this would follow from the standard yoga of the short exact sequence and long exact sequence business. So V is defined on Ami twister space, and it is, by construction, the corresponding elements of the cohomology group. And for n equals 2, we can think of this function g as being the variation in the Hamiltonian defining the null geodesic spray. And for g equals variation of the metric. And the delta function support of this k dot p term is going to be the scattering equations that formed the center of Freddy's talks. Okay, so that's the main point I wanted to get to today. I just wanted to make one final remark here, is that at no point today have we said anything about field equations. This does not satisfy, n equals minus 1, it doesn't satisfy the wave equation. N equals 1 doesn't satisfy Maxwell equations, which is what you might hope, or it doesn't satisfy the linearized Einstein equations, and in fact is conformally invariant. A lot of the effort from the 70s and 80s was to finding expressions of the field equations. And Witten had the idea, both in 4 and in 10 dimensions, that this was associated to the existence of a super symmetric extension of the ideas. Eisenberg, Jetic, and Green had the idea that we could understand what was going on by, in 4 dimensions at least, by extending, instead of supersymmetrically, they did it sort of, so to speak, bosonically, but they had an extension of ambi twister space. So this is a 5-dimensional ambi twister space in 4 dimensions into a projective space in its dual. This was z dot w equals 0. And this was the way that myself and Claude de Brum were working. We were finding field equations arising at extension to third, fourth, and fifth order. Third order for Yang-Mills, fifth order for conformal gravity, and sixth order for Einstein gravity. And then it stopped, because we didn't really know what to do with these ideas. The process of finding these quadrics in ambi twister space is a big, cumbersome thing to do. And this was not an idea that extended to other dimensions, and it wasn't a very useful idea. What the ambi twister strings do is they kind of resolve a lot of these issues. They show that actually just looking at Riemann surfaces inside ambi twister space is enough. And what we see is that field equations are going to come out of quantum consistency of the ambi twister string. So that'll be tomorrow. So I'm sorry for running over time.
Any questions?
wanted to ask one question. So the example is important. I think that we understand how this relates to the double vibration.
Yeah.
So could you just indicate briefly which function is on which space?
Sorry. Yeah. So G, we're really so the G with indices, of course, lives on space-time. We then lifted it to this correspondent space by contracting it into just a scalar quantity on ambitvistis on the correspondent space QM.
At that point, it's a polynomial function.
But it's just a polynomial function up and down the fibers.
Yeah.
And then we try to run through this short exact sequence. You see, you try and say, well, I've got a function here on QM. I try and pull it back to a function in there, see if there's something in here such that P dot Nabla on that function is equal to this. So you can certainly write down such a thing, but it's no longer holomorphic. It's got this pole, 1 over K dot P in it. You hit this with P dot K, and you hit this with P dot Nabla, you'll bring down the K dot P from that differentiation. And that will get rid of the pole. Sorry, yeah. So K is a constant vector, and epsilon is another constant, in fact, null vector.
A null vector, okay.
Well, it has to be null just for this thing to be trace-free.
Kappa also.
That was the problem, you see, that these things are all off-shell at this stage. But they will become on-shell tomorrow. So this is very much chasing through the... Sorry, I really cramped up this discussion here, the non-exact sequence in cohomology from the short exact sequence of sheaves.
I see. And then finally, the V, this V is the result of applying delta in connecting homomorphism to G.
That's right.
I see.
So that is what you get, and this is the cohomology class that you...
So from this, you're saying that basically deformations of an n-index symmetric tensor are measured by H1 on the
n-index space.
Right.
Yeah. And because we use the momentum eigenstate, you can see that it's true for all, that spans the space of all functions.
Any further question?
If you start with the, say, real algebraic variety as your initial manifold, so there's no convergence issues.
Yeah.
Like just take RPN or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Then what is this ambitwister space that you get? It's something specific, like that one can say for projective space.
I need to think what it was in that sort of case. So you just put a random, well, I mean, for a flat metric on RPN or round metric on RPN.
Restriction of
all in situations like the one you're describing, that would have a very wide complexification. So you would find, maybe if you're lucky, if you chose well, it could even be compact, I guess. Well, no, the G, it's unlikely to be compact by Liouville's theorem, so it would have singularities somewhere. The easy examples are, of course, flat space, and there you're essentially getting something which is topologically a Cartesian product of these quadrics with CD minus 1. But it's non-trivial, so there's some twist in it this may be the most useful way to think about it is that topologically you just have that smooth Cartesian product, but complex analytically, it's not a Cartesian product, and there's some non-triviality.
Okay, let's thank one more.